Всім добрий вечір. Всі ми тут.
On behalf of the brave. On behalf of our world. On behalf of the brave. Wings for freedom.
Шановні громадяни України.
Hello and welcome to Kochi Weekly, the show that gets behind the headlines to discuss the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine. We broadcast every Sunday at 1800 UTC. Please follow the main account on Twitter for more information about other projects we're doing. For example, our resident economist Ben will be interviewing Rachel Ziemba on Twitter about economic policy this Wednesday at 1500 UTC. We're all looking forward to that. A recording of this broadcast and all our content can be found on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and a variety of other podcast platforms. We have a great broadcast for you today. First, we will be looking at a panel discussion in honor of Ukrainian Independence Day. Next, Charles Rye, and John Ridge will tell us everything we currently know about the exciting news that officials have for the first time confirmed that F-16 airframes will be provided to Ukraine. And finally, we have an excellent presentation today by Daniela, who will look at the production of artillery shells in the UK as a case study for how the modern shell industry works. So without any further delay, I will turn it over to Jonathan. Jonathan, over to you.
Thank you, Joseph. Dobro vecher. Hello, everybody. In the lead up to the marking of their Independence Day and the 32nd anniversary since their independence from the Soviet Empire, we are going to be hearing the voices of Ukrainians on what this particular anniversary means for them. We have witnessed, of course, this week from afar, as we do every week, Ukrainians demonstrating the continuity of their society, their culture, their existence, despite being subject to war crimes like we have seen this week in Chernihiv. So we are hoping to be joined quite soon by a couple of Ukrainians, one Vasil, who is going to be phoning in live from Dnipro, because he's going to talk to us a little bit about how Ukrainian participation in the decision-making processes within their own communities, how these have continued. But we're very lucky to be joined by Andrei, who is up here on the speaker panel with us. Hello, Andrei. It's great to see you here.
Hi, Jonathan. Great to see you and pleasure to participate in our today's stream.
It's fantastic to have you here. So, Andrei, I guess my first question is, could you perhaps tell us about some of the traditions which Ukrainians generally, or from the community where your family is from, some of the traditions that they practice on Ukrainian Independence Day?
Yeah, Jonathan, thank you very much for your question. Really, the Independence Day is a kind of holiday or kind of special days that should be understood by society in its own way. And talking about the traditions, we know that Ukrainian Independence Day takes place in summer, and most of people usually normally have the different summer parties with barbecues, something like that. Some people travel to rivers, lakes to celebrate this day. Talking about my family, we spent mostly this fest together, grilling or something like that, celebrating this holiday. Talking about the states level, in previous years especially, and also even before the not full-scale invasion, but even before the war that started in year 2014, we had the military parade on the main streets of Kiev, on Khreshchatyk, and we understand that after year 2014, this parade has its own role to show that Ukrainians have the power and the strength to defend the thing that they celebrate this day, their independence. Yeah. However, I would like also to outline that we are calling this day as the day of our independence, as it's dedicated to the day when Ukraine became the independent state from the Soviet Union in the year 1991. But I would like to mention that Ukraine state building process has long tradition, more than 1,000 years, and maybe here we are talking not only about our independence, but about the reborn of our state, like other European nations that also had different periods in their histories that have left their independence in one period, but now they have it. And I think that we also can talk about it if we're talking about the Ukrainian Day of Independence.
Thanks, Andrei. Yeah, I mean, going out onto the streets is completely understandable, given that Ukrainians lived through decades and centuries of having and being unable to do this due to the oppression of the Russian Soviet Empire. Would you say that there's generational differences in how Ukrainians celebrate their Independence Day? You know, is it a family occasion? Are there things which are kind of new in terms of things which are practiced? And could you give us a rough idea of some kind of the traditional practices?
Thank you very much for your question, Jonathan. Answering the question, if it's how different are they, how the different generations of Ukrainians celebrate this holiday, I would rather say that it's not an issue of generations, rather issue of consciousness. And yeah, for example, in my family, all generations, like my generation of my parents, my grandparents, we celebrate it all together. And I have such a feeling, such an impression that the level, how strong, I mean, like normals, yeah, how strong this holiday is celebrated in Ukraine, it really depends on the level of consciousness of the people, not in their age. And currently, yeah, there are no doubts that all Ukrainians see what is our independence, what is its price, and how many dangerous things it's faced. And this is why I would say that today, especially today, and time before, but also especially today, the Day of Independence in Ukraine is rather the thing that can unite, serve as tool for uniting the different generations. And for me today, it's rather the family holiday. This is my family, we celebrated with the whole generations of our family.
Thanks, Andrei. That's quite interesting to hear. I was going to ask you a question. I think you've answered it, about changes that Ukrainians have had to make to the way that they celebrate Independence Day, given what's happening in their country, given that they live in a war zone and their lives are continuously under threat on a daily basis. So I'm going to ask you this. If you had to teach one Ukrainian tradition to a British person who couldn't cook and couldn't dance, what tradition would you teach?
First of all, I wouldn't agree that British people couldn't cook, because one of the greatest chefs in the world today is Gordon Ramsay. Yeah, so, yeah, but talking about traditions, what to teach, first of all, I'd like to say that I'm not the best person to teach something about the dances, because I'm not an expert in this area, absolutely, but talking about the food the dishes that would suit not only to this holiday, but to any summer holiday or just to cozy summer evening. It's the dish that came to Ukraine from the Caucasus region. It's called shashlik. It's like pieces of meat that are grilled on the open fire and that are prepared before the grilling with a special sauce, with a special spices. And yeah, it's really delicious, and yeah, I can say that it really suits to a really cozy and pleasurable summer evening. So I can just recommend this dish.
All right, I have to say I'm kind of surprised that you chose to defend British cuisine there. I appreciate it, though. Thank you. Is there a generational difference here? So would your parents' generation or your grandparents' generation having different answers to this question? You know, so what would they choose to teach a terrible cook and a terrible dancer from my small part of the world?
So, I haven't answered on the question about the dances, because, as I said, I'm not a dancer at all. This is why it's really hard for me to teach something in this area. But talking about the differences in generations in cooking, in this aspect, like food for this holiday or any other holiday in summer, I would say that this, the Thai culture stick, it's rather the, it's more, it comes rather from the older generations. My generation today, for example, can mix it with different steaks or sausages. So I would say if we're talking especially about the food part of this holiday, the younger generations, they are tending to make it more, to make the grill dishes more diverse. But grill for these holidays, especially and for Independence Day, is like kind of strong tradition that exists today in Ukraine.
Thank you. Thank you, Andre. We've got a couple of hands up. Charles, please go ahead.
Hi, yeah. I've just been looking at the news throughout the day today, and basically, at least in the country where I live, in Germany, there have been celebrations in most of the major cities. I think the largest one today is planned in Cologne. Yeah, I'm just curious, Andre, will you be doing any, have you done anything today or heard about other celebrations in your area? For people to come and experience, there's like talent shows and dancing and food markets and all kinds of things.
Charles, thank you very much for your question. Basically, I haven't heard today about the great events in my area, but I'm pretty sure that something is going to happen. But I think that the amount of activities like with Ukrainian topics, it rise today in the region of Germany where I live at this moment. And for example, there was this week, there was a concert of one Ukrainian group, TNVK, in Berlin. And it, unfortunately, I had no opportunity to visit it, but friends of mine have visited it. And it's like a wonderful combination of, not combination, but a wonderful vibe when both Ukrainian and German people there. Ukrainian music, they have a great time together. And basically, it's a good question if something great is spent on the Ukrainian Independence Day in Berlin. But if yes, I would be curious to visit it.
John, please go ahead.
Thank you. Andre, I want to ask, have you observed any, in what ways have you observed fusions of older, more traditional ways of celebrating Ukrainian independence and Ukrainian identity with newer ways or more modern and popular ways of celebrating Ukrainian independence and cultural identity?
Thank you for your question, John. I would like, first of all, to understand what do you mean under the modern ways to celebrate it. You mean like going out somewhere or maybe I just didn't get your question.
Sorry, what I was trying to ask was, my assumption was that perhaps Ukrainian independence was, perhaps celebrated somewhat differently, 10, 20 years ago, and that, the exact way that it has been celebrated has probably changed over time. If that assumption is incorrect, then, my apologies for that. But I was trying to get a sense of how those traditions have changed over time and mixed together both the new and the old.
Yeah, John, thank you very much for your question. I think that Ukrainian Independence Day, as it is today, it's relatively the young holiday. Ukraine in its today's borders, its today's state form exists since 1991. But how I mentioned before, Ukrainians have a huge state building traditions. But currently not about it. I think that as this holiday is relatively young, some kind of heart of strong established traditions, they are rather just forming on this day. It really depends from one family to another, but as far as I know, and also based on the experience of my friend, for example, it's rather the family holiday. But I can imagine it that these sound traditions would change in the future. For example, basically, in previous years, we had the situations when people celebrated the Independence Day in the center of the city, the Khrushchev Street, for example. It was like kind of way of celebration with all the people around, with the Ukrainian society. It's also another way to celebrate it, and we had a few cases of it in previous years. But talking about future, how can we change the way of celebration? Hard to say, hard to imagine, but one thing I can say for sure, the weight and the role of this holiday will become more and more larger and important. I hope that I have answered your question.
Thank you, Andrew. That's fantastic. And we're really lucky to be joined also by Vassil. Welcome up, Vassil. I think Vassil's having a few connection issues. I was going to ask him the same question. Vassil, I don't know if you can hear us, but if you had to teach one Ukrainian tradition to a British person who couldn't cook and couldn't dance, what tradition would you teach? All right. Give us a quick mic check again when you've got moved to a different location, Vassil. All right. Okay. So, Andre, just while we wait for Vassil, could you tell us about one memory you have of Ukrainian Independence Day for when you were a child? One thing which was particularly memorable for you.
Yeah, sure, Jonathan. Thank you for the question. And yeah, this question makes me a little bit nostalgic and takes me to the past. And I really enjoy this feeling. So great pleasure for this question. And yeah, basically I have one. The things that I remember from the childhood regarding this holiday, for example, which I remember is that every time on Independence Day, my family and I celebrated in the house, not in the city, but outside the city. Yeah, like small house just for summer relax. And the whole family, I remember it really good. Once it was like that, it was the end of the August. In a few weeks, I'm going to go to school, and the whole family sits on the table, like, cook something, and we are watching the military parade on the Khreshchatyk Street. This, I was a young child, but when I have seen our army with all this technique, I felt really so proud about it. Like, here is one of the signs of our strength. I'm pretty sure, and at that moment, I could also understand that we have a lot of sides of our strength, but it was one of them, Ukrainian army, our army. And as I was proud at that time as a child, I'm also proud today and fascinated of our heroes that today are defending Ukraine from orcas.
Thank you, Andre. I really appreciate you taking the time to answer these questions. What we're going to do, folks, is we're going to return to this topic later when we've got a couple of tech issues sorted. So in the meantime, I'm delighted to say that I'm going to hand over to John Ridge, who is going to give us the latest on Griffin and a couple of other fascinating topics. Over to you, John.
Thank you, Jonathan. So obviously, as I assume we've all seen by this point today, finally have announcements that F-16s, the airframe specific, will be delivered to Ukraine by Ukraine's allies and partners. In this case, we have announcements from the Netherlands and Denmark, along with specific numbers of airframes. This is what the actual number is has been a matter of some contention online due to the rather vague nature of some of the statements that were released by the Dutch government. But what we know so far is that Denmark is delivering 19 F-16 AMs, to be more specific, F-16A Block 10 and Block 15 MLUs, midlife upgrades. And then the Dutch are delivering a currently undisclosed number of F-16 AM and BM, again, Block 10, Block 15 MLUs. The confusion has arisen in that Denmark specifically, the Danish government explicitly stated they would be delivering 9 airframes. The Dutch did not explicitly say. Mark Rutte, the prime minister, in his press conference, did not reference a specific figure. President Zelensky and chief of staff, André Yermak, they both posted tweets indicating that the Dutch would be providing 42 F-16s in total, which represents the entirety of the Dutch Air Force's current inventory of F-16 airframes minus 6 that are currently slated to be resold to another customer. However, the Dutch government has not explicitly confirmed that specific figure. So potentially we are looking at either 42 total airframes or 61, depending on what clarification the Dutch government issues. the additional layer of confusion here is that you might think that 42, specifically that number, makes sense because it's the entirety of their inventory. But if you subtract the 19 from it, then that becomes 23, which is the exact number of currently active airframes that are not in storage that the Royal Netherlands Air Force operates. So either one is really equally plausible. So hopefully, maybe later today or tomorrow, we will get clarification from the Dutch MOD. But as of right now, that what the specific total is still in flux. Beyond those two countries, Norway has previously, quote-unquote, joined the, quote, F-16 coalition to provide training and airframes to the Ukrainian armed forces. As far as I'm aware, they are not quite as far along in the process as Denmark and the Netherlands are. Just the other day, Denmark and the Netherlands both received formal licensure from the U.S. State Department to re-export the necessary training materials to Ukraine, as well as a written promise from Secretary of State Antony Blinken that when the time comes to actually transfer those airframes themselves to the Ukrainian government, they will receive prompt re-export. They will receive a prompt re-export license from the State Department. As far as I'm aware, Norway has yet to apply for and receive a re-export license for the training materials. So if they are to give airframes, that will likely, we won't see any announcements about that probably for another, you know, few weeks. But the potential for them to donate and for the, you know, absolute total of airframes delivered has the potential to rise. They have, I believe, 12 to 24 left. All of theirs have been retired, and about 32 are being sold to Romania. So depending on how you count them, they have either 12 to 24 airframes remaining that they don't really have a slated use for. Regarding delivery schedules for the aircraft, the Dutch have not provided a delivery schedule. The Danes said that I believe 6 will be delivered around the end of this year, beginning of next year. A further 8, I believe, will be delivered sometime midway into next year. And the remainder of their 19 will be delivered close to the end of 2024, beginning of 2025. And then again, we're obviously still waiting on the Dutch Ministry of Defense to publish a timeline, if they're going to publish one. So the Ukrainians will not be receiving these airframes all at once. There will be a phased process for training, for doing conversion training for Ukrainian pilots to get them up to speed on these airframes. And that's going to take several months to play out. Realistically, we are looking at probably 4 to 6 months of conversion training, in addition to probably a couple months of English fluency lessons for some of the pilots. My understanding, if I'm remembering the press release from the Ukrainian Air Force correctly, was that they had eight or so pilots that are currently ready to begin training, conversion training, as is, and that have an acceptable level of English fluency. There's another about 24 or so that have some English fluency but need some improvement before training can begin. And I believe they're slated to receive a 3 to 4 month English course in the UK provided by the Royal Air Force in the interim. So once that's completed, then they can actually begin conversion training on the F-16s. It was also announced either yesterday or the day before by the commander of USAGE, United States Air Force Europe, that it looks like we've already begun the training pipeline for novice Ukrainian pilots to begin operating the F-16s. So this is really the long-term component of this training effort. So whereas the Ukraine's existing pilots, they will be receiving conversion training from the MiG-29s and the Su-27s to the F-16s, potentially from the Su-24Ms and the Su-25s as well, eventually. These novice pilots don't really have, they aren't trained to fly a specific airframe yet. These are, you know, quite literally novice pilots who are going to be in their first or second year of training. They will go directly into the F-16 pipeline, it looks like. So they will presumably, you know, get their training on their basic trainers and their advanced trainer aircraft and then move on to F-16 specific training. So they're already directly in that pipeline. As I said, it'll take a couple of years for that to bear fruit. You know, we're talking probably a total of 4 to 5 years of training here to get them truly up to speed to where they need to be. So that really falls into the long-term sustainment aspect of things. And beyond the F-16s, there was also discussion that, or announcement, I should say, by the Swedish government that a number of Ukrainian pilots had received familiarization training on Saab's JAS-39 or JAS-39 Gripen, which is the principal fixed-wing asset operated by the Swedish Air Force and a couple of other users globally. There's been extensive discussion since the invasion began as to which airframe would be more optimal for Ukraine's needs, either the F-16 or the Gripen. The Ukrainian Air Force has shown the most interest, as far as I can tell, in the F-16 and the Gripen, obviously with a clear focus on the F-16. What will come of this? I'm not sure. When it was initially announced they'd be receiving familiarization training, the wording was such that it was made pretty explicitly clear that this was familiarization training in case the Ukrainian government wanted to place a commercial order with Saab post-war for Gripens. Whether or not that's changed or that wasn't true at the time the announcement was made, I'm not sure. But there is a possibility that a transfer of Gripens could occur. And that's certainly that is a card that could be played, but it's still very early days. The way the announcement was phrased was very much that Ukraine wanted to open discussions with the Swedish government regarding a potential transfer. So at this point, any kind of possibility of that is still very nascent. Charles, please go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to add just maybe one thing. So yeah, so Zelensky was in Eindhoven in the Netherlands earlier today. I think he landed about just after noon local time and had a press conference with Prime Minister Rutte at Eindhoven, and then immediately flew to Denmark, where he met with his counterpart at Denmark again at an airbase in front of an F-16. That was just a few hours ago that took place. I just had one comment here. This is from the public broadcaster in the Netherlands, where Prime Minister Rutte confirms the number of 42 F-16s. He said, of the 42 F-16s, we need some for training in Denmark and later in Romania. And of course, they're looking at whether they can deliver all the remaining fighter aircraft. Things need to be done to prepare them, so he can't give the exact number yet. So he is saying 42, but some of them will be needed for training. Also mentioned in this from the Dutch public broadcaster is that one of the lieutenant generals had earlier confirmed in the Royal Netherlands Army is that they have used some of these aircraft to cannibalize in order to keep others flying. So it will be some time before they're all ready to go. But they are mentioning, Rutte stated in the press conference that the training for the pilots starts this month in Denmark and then will continue in Romania. So that's what just came out just a couple of hours ago, maybe to help.
Right. And just to add a little bit of clarity to that. So, and as I referenced earlier, the Royal Netherlands Air Force has 23 F-16 AMs, which is the single seat variant in active service. More than likely, those would be the ones transferred to Ukraine. Beyond that, they have 25 in storage, 18 AMs and 7 BMs. Of those, I believe 6 currently have a sale pending or resale pending to an export customer. Not sure who the customer is off the top of my head. That leaves 19 remaining after that. What I would imagine is that regarding Romania, the BMs, the two-seaters, those are usually used for training. So more than likely, if there was to be an additional allocation from the Netherlands, it would be some of those AMs, probably minus any that had been cannibalized for parts and minus however many of those are being sold. And then the BMs would probably be used or kept in Dutch inventory for both training Ukrainian pilots as well as training Romanian pilots, potentially, obviously minus however many BMs are going to be sold to that export customer. And then regarding the Danes, a little bit more clarification there. They have 43 in active service, 33 AMs, 10 BMs, and then I believe they have an additional 6 AMs stored. All of those 19 that have been pledged are AMs, so that leaves them with 14 after that. There has been discussion in some media outlets that the State Department has given Denmark a re-export license to sell 24 F-16s to Argentina, which is a rather unexpected development in the middle of all of this. So how many Denmark eventually ends up sending, I suspect will be contingent on what happens with that potential sale to Argentina. The Argentines really, really want new aircraft because they don't really have functional ones that are modern due to a variety of complicated export stuff that I'm not going to get into right now. But in any case, there is the possibility that sale might not go through because Argentina is, for lack of a better term, broke right now. So whether or not they could actually afford to buy those is an open question, even though the State Department has already given Denmark approval for that re-export. So depending on where that goes, we might see the number of airframes pledged by Denmark change. And again, I would suspect that the B versions would probably stay the longest in Danish inventory because those would be used for Ukrainian pilots, as well as potentially training Argentine pilots should that deal go through. And then, yeah, I think that kind of rounds out the inventory figures. So in terms of, I guess, been a lot of discussion for ages now, but what the impact of F-16s and just more generally, what the impact of Western fixed-wing assets is going to be on the battlefield for Ukraine. The range of opinions expressed online about this has varied wildly from that it will be decisive, that it will have no impact at all. So unfortunately, I'm going to pour a decent bit of freezing water on some of the more, I guess, optimistic hopes regarding their impact on the battlefield. There's a couple elements to this. So the F-16s alone will not be decisive in the war. They will not give Ukraine a decisive edge that will enable any kind of rapid defeat of the Russian armed forces in the occupied parts of Ukraine. That just simply is not realistic. It's not in the cards. On the one hand, that's just simply because these F-16s are not being delivered all at once. There is necessarily a phased approach because there's only a certain number of pilots, a limited number, that can be trained currently. There's others that have to be brought to speed up on their English fluency. And then on top of that, Ukraine needs to maintain pilots flying their MiG-29s, their Su-27s, their other airframes in order to continue their ongoing air operations, so they can't just pull all of their pilots for F-16 training. That's just simply not possible. So this is going to, as I said earlier, this is going to be a phased approach that's going to take place over probably 1 to 2 years. And so it won't have a decisive immediate impact on the one hand because of that. And additionally, beyond that, the specific airframes that Ukraine is receiving, the Block 10, Block 15 MLUs, are really old. They're really, really old. Block 10, Block 15s, they were some of the first F-16 variants introduced into service. Obviously, they've received some pretty substantial upgrades as part of the mid-life upgrade program, but they're still lacking in a lot of areas. So, for example, in terms of air-to-air capabilities, it's a definite upgrade from the Su-27s and the MiG-29s, but it's still nowhere technologically competitive with the Su-35, for example, or any of Russia's most modern fixed-wing fighters. An F-16 AM or BM has absolutely no hope in an air-to-air engagement directly with the VKS. It's just simply not realistic. The Ukrainian armed forces, unfortunately, do not have access to the supporting assets that enable, for example, the United States Air Force to do many of the things it can do with air power. They don't have access to airborne early warning control aircraft such as AWACS. They don't have access to electronic attack aircraft like the Growler, like Compass Call. They don't have airborne surface search radar or attack radars like JSTARS. There's just a lot of these capabilities that are really necessary to leverage overwhelming air power that the Ukraine will not realistically be able to field. Now, where does that leave us in terms of what these F-16s will enable? So what they're going to be able to do is, the first concern regarding the legacy Soviet airframes the Ukraine is operating is that they're unsustainable. There are not very many places to get spare parts. There was Ukraine, Russia, Poland had some, and a couple of the other former Warsaw Pact members that are now in NATO had spare parts as well. That supply and the ability to produce new spare parts is essentially basically exhausted at this point. The aircraft physically cannot be maintained in the medium to long term. They will literally start falling apart or falling out of the sky. So they have to be replaced just based upon that. The F-16 is a platform that the United States and Ukraine's other allies can sustain, repair, maintain, service, etc., essentially indefinitely for the next 10, 15 plus years. So this will lock them into a platform that they will have the industrial base to support for more or less the indefinite future of this war, which is a very positive change. Additionally, it will really open up the trade space for them in terms of being able to perform really three key tasks. And people can debate what the relative importance of each of them is, but really the core three are, in terms of air-to-air capabilities, these airframes will enable Ukraine to more effectively perform what are known as defensive counter-air missions and to implement air-based air defense against Russian cruise missiles and one-way attack UAVs like the Shahed 136. So air-based air defense is a really, really important part of Ukraine's overall integrated air and missile defense scheme. It's difficult to do that with the MiG-29s and the Su-27s. The F-16s will help with that. They won't be a panacea, but they will definitely help, which is going to be a very important consideration going forward, especially as Russia, they have made large investments into their capacity to produce one-way attack UAVs, the Shahed 136 factory, and Tatarstan specifically, for example. So as we get into the winter, as more Russian capacity to produce cruise missiles and one-way attack UAVs comes online, having these additional airframes to be able to perform that defensive counter-air role will be critical to maintaining the current level of efficacy of Ukraine's air defenses. And in terms of air-to-ground, F-16s really, really open up a new world of standoff munition employment. So unfortunately, as it currently stands right now, although they have received anti-radiation missiles like HARM, the Ukrainian Air Force can't really do effective seed and deed suppression and destruction of enemy air defenses in the way that, say, the United States Air Force can do. Their ability to operate is really, really constrained by Russian air defense assets such as S-300P, S-400, Buk, Tor, Pantsir, etc. And so they have been largely forced to employ munitions from standoff ranges such as glide bombs, cruise missiles, etc. The F-16s will really open up the availability, the variety and quantity of standoff munitions available to them. So, for example, there is JDAM-ER, but once they have F-16s, they will begin to be able to use what are known as SDBs, small diameter bombs, which the U.S. has very large numbers of, and which Boeing currently has a very large production capacity for that is essentially entirely unused, on the order of 8,000 to 10,000 bombs per year. This will really give Ukraine the ability to leverage air-to-surface fires to supplement their existing surface-to-surface fires. So we're talking, again, SDB, JDAM-ER, as Boeing facilitizes to a higher production rate of that specifically. And that will enable Ukraine to take some of the pressure off of sustaining their surface-to-surface fires, like Gimlers, 155mm shells, etc., that we are currently trying to ramp production for. In terms of concerns that Ukraine may fall short on ammunition sustainment before additional production comes online next year, the F-16s will enable Ukraine to effectively diversify their portfolio of fires assets, take some of that pressure off their surface assets, and be able to better weather any potential ammunition shortfall, again, while we get more production online to sustain their consumption in the long term. And then it'll also enable things like, for example, JASSM. There are a limited number of Storm Shadows. There are a limited number of Tauruses. MBDA UK's line for Storm Shadow is currently offline. Taurus is not currently produced. MBDA France does have a production line running for Storm Shadow, I believe, currently fulfilling orders for Greece. But the number in inventory and that can be produced currently is fairly limited. Once they have F-16s, then we can begin to look at supplementing that with JASSMs, which is the United States' primary air launch cruise missile that we have very large numbers of, on the order of a couple thousand, with production capacity for about 1,000 per year. That's a whole separate, very touchy political discussion as to whether or not that would actually be provided, but at least that possibility now exists to supplement any shortfall and, again, sustain fires in the long run. And the third important aspect is really ISTAR, intelligence, surveillance, target acquisition, reconnaissance. Those F-16s, they can mount targeting pods such as Sniper, Lightning, etc. There's a variety of different targeting pods and reconnaissance pods. They can do things like, you know, designate targets for laser-guided bombs. They can generate mensuration grids for fire missions for, you know, small-diameter bombs, JDAM-ERs, or even surface fires like Gimlers, etc. the Ukrainians can really begin to shorten their kill chain in terms of how long it takes them to go from identifying a target to actually executing that fire mission. So, for example, they could take that time down from, you know, say 60 minutes in the case of Gimlers to say 5 minutes. Obviously, that's being a little bit optimistic, but just kind of illustrate the point. They can really kind of compress that kill chain and make their entire faster reacting and more lethal because of that. So what I was saying is that I was talking about sustaining Ukrainian fires there and diversifying their portfolio of fires assets to avoid any kind of the potential risk of, say, an ammunition shortfall in the fall as we were in the fall going into the winter as we wait for more ammunition production to come online, such as for the 155mm shells, Gimlers, etc. What I was saying was that the current existing inventories of Storm Shadow and Taurus are fairly limited. NVDA France has a production line for Taurus currently running, but that's it. Taurus production ended in 2019, and NVDA UK's Storm Shadow line is currently offline. Both of those could be restarted if there was a large order to be placed, but obviously that's a contingent event. Somebody would need to place that order and pay for it, presumably out of the UK, Germany, Ukrainian governments. Once they have F-16s, if there was to be a shortfall in the availability of air-launched cruise missiles, Taurus or Storm Shadow, the F-16s are integrated with JASSM, which is the U.S.'s standard air-launched cruise missile. We have about production capacity for about 1,000 per year, a couple thousand in inventory. That is something that we could potentially supply to them to cover up, to cover any potential shortfall there. In terms of Storm Shadow or Taurus, it'd be a politically sensitive delivery for the U.S. because we have an overwhelming need to stockpile them for any potential conflict in the Pacific. They're absolutely integral to our war reserve needs there, but it could be done if needed. Beyond that, again, there's small diameter bombs that they'll now have access to, large U.S. Air Force inventory, about 30,000 units. Boeing has capacity for around 9,000 units per year, of which most of that capacity is effectively unused. I think only 1,000 units of that are currently being produced. And then there's things like AARGM, which is an improved version of HARM. We have capacity for about 300 units of that per year, all totally unused. So it really opens up that trade space of availability of standoff munitions, both just in terms of variety and quantity, and that will help sustain their fires capabilities in the long term. The third capability that the F-16s bring to the table is ISTAR, intelligence, surveillance, target acquisition, and reconnaissance. So the F-16s, they can mount a variety of targeting pods, Lightning, Sniper, and there's a couple of other targeting reconnaissance pods out there as well. Those can be used to generate mensuration grids for precision-guided munitions like JDAM-ER, small-diameter bombs, even surface-to-surface fires like Gimlers, etc., Excalibur. That would enable the Ukrainians to obviously just perform more effective ISTAR in general, having that airborne ISTAR capability, but it will more specifically enable them to really compress and shorten their kill chain, potentially by a significant amount, you know, from say 60 minutes to 5 minutes for a Gimlers fire mission, again, depending on how well they can operationalize that capability, which remains to be seen in practice, of course, but there is that ability for the F-16s to really synergize with all of the other assets the Ukraine already has and really to make everything more lethal and more effective because of this capability. And so that's those three factors: that air-to-air capability against cruise missiles and one-way attack UAVs, that ability to help sustain standoff air-to-surface fires to supplement their existing surface-to-surface fires capabilities, and their ability to provide that ISTAR capability. All of those three things together don't make the F-16s a decisive platform, but they more broadly make, you know, the Ukrainian armed forces as a whole more effective, more lethal. They enable the war effort to be sustained for a much longer period of time than what would be possible with just the MiG-29s, the Su-27s, even though the impact may not be decisive, also, you know, sustaining ammunition. So overall, it puts them on a better footing to continue to prosecute this war as long as they need to liberate all of the occupied territories.
Thanks a lot for that, John. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense now that I think of, you know, as you're describing it to me, the capabilities that does offer. But of course, then the timeline that we're looking at for this is unfortunately still long and a staged approach. Have there been any announcement about the availability of certain pods, and I don't remember all the names of them, but the anti-radiation, these targeting pods and these kinds of things that the F-16 can carry. Have there been any announcements about any of that, or we'll just have to see as time goes along?
So the MLUs have a couple of them integrated. I know Sniper's integrated. I know HTS, the harm targeting system, is integrated. Neither the Netherlands, Denmark, or Norway, none of them ever operated harm or HTS. So if Ukraine wants those pods, they're going to have to get them from the U.S., presumably. I don't think the Belgians operated them either, so I'm pretty sure they'd have to get those targeting pods from U.S. Air Force inventory, or maybe U.S. Navy inventory. For Sniper, I think, I want to say there was one or two European operators of it. I need to go and check. I don't remember who it was specifically, so those could potentially be provided alongside the F-16s. But if they needed them in any quantity, I'd suspect they'd have to get them from the U.S. Air Force or the U.S. Navy.
Real quick on Sniper, just doing a quick check. I haven't validated all this, but it seems that Belgium and the Norwegians and possibly the Dutch as well do have Sniper in inventory.
Yeah, so that, I mean, if there was a need, and depending on the specific numbers, those could potentially be supplied with the F-16s as is. And Vassal, please go ahead.
Hello, everybody. Sorry for my bad connection. John, I have one question. Do you heard about some information about terms when it can be happened?
Right. So the Dutch haven't made any specific announcements about the timeline yet. As far as I'm aware, as of a couple hours ago today, the Danes, they said that the first, I believe, 6 airframes will be delivered to Ukraine around the end of this year. So either a little bit before New Year's or a little bit after. I think the next 8 airframes will be delivered to Ukraine midway through next year. And then the remaining Danish airframes will be delivered towards the end of 2024, beginning of 2025. So it's going to be staged over the next year or so, year and a half, about 18 months. And then the Dutch, they have yet to publish a schedule.
Okay, thank you very much, John, for that update on the F-16. And that really helps understand not only the timeline, the extent, but also the capabilities that this offers. We were speaking about one thing a little bit earlier. Oh, sorry, go ahead. Colby, if you have something on the F-16s before we change topics. Colby?
Thanks. John, now, one of the munitions you didn't mention that you and I have been talking about is SLAM-ER. And as we've been discussing, it in my mind, this might be one of the more probable systems that Ukraine could get because it's not featuring heavily in the discourse around what the United States's munitions needs are for operations in Indo-Pacific Command theater. It seems more likely that that's a system that could be plausibly provided, where, you know, whereas JASSM is something that a lot of people in Washington are talking about as a system that the United States needs to procure more of for their own needs. So just curious if you wanted to speak a little bit about that for the benefit of the audience.
Yes, thank you very much for reminding me. So SLAM-ER is a modified version. It's a derivative of the Harpoon anti-ship missile, modified and essentially more or less enlarged for a standoff land attack capability for the U.S. Navy originally. The Navy procured, I think, about 700 of them. That was their inventory target as of the early 2000s. They've expended a couple of them since then, so I think the total figure is probably around 650 or so currently in U.S. Navy inventory. In terms of SLAM-ER is a very attractive standoff choice for Ukraine because of the fact that there is an existing active production line for FMS customers. There is no current, there's no current U.S. demand for it. The production line is only fulfilling an FMS order for Saudi Arabia right now for their FA-18s. So that line orders for them, if the Saudi government's willing, their orders could be delayed. Production could be redirected from Ukraine or for Ukraine. We could pull some from U.S. Navy inventory. And we can also, Boeing could expand the line, the SLAM-ER line. To help sustain Ukraine's expenditure in the long term. Those are very attractive and cost-effective options. The only downside is that the SLAM-ER is not currently integrated with the European or U.S. F-16s. It was designed for U.S. Navy use, so it was integrated with the FA-18. The Turks, they do operate it, and they had it integrated with their F-16s. So an integration package does exist, but we need to take some time to probably do some software up to whatever F-16s Ukraine receives in order to make them compatible with SLAM-ER. But as a long-term choice for standoff munitions in the about the 300-kilometer range interval, I believe they cap out 270, 300-kilometer range, SLAM-ER is a very attractive and sustainable option.
Okay, thanks a lot, John. I just wanted to bring up one other side topic. It's not a side topic, but it's not about F-16s. And this is sort of this on-again, off-again Rheinmetall tank production in Ukraine topic. The German defense systems, weapons supplier, manufacturer has been talking about doing things in Ukraine for several months. But I think there's some news there. Am I right?
Yes. So the CEO of Rheinmetall, whose name I don't really remember, he gave an interview, I think, with one of the German outlets about 2 days ago. And he had some news on the shells front. He announced that, I believe beginning sometime next year, Rheinmetall will be able to provide, 600,000 155-millimeter shells per year and deliver them to Ukraine. His wording was a little bit vague as to what the specific timing of this would be. He said 600,000 shells annually from next year, quote. So I don't know if that means that that capacity will be stood up, you know, say by the middle of next year, by the end of next year, you know, if it's going to be 12 or 18 months from now. I'm not really sure what that specific timeline is going to be like or it's going to look like. But Rheinmetall, should have that capacity at least by the end of next year. And that alone should be able to cover about half of Ukraine's 155 consumption, which is a very, very positive development. And to be honest, I'm surprised they were able to scale that quickly. That is dramatically fast. That's about more or less a little under half, or a little over half, I should say, of the production output the U.S. is planning. So that's a really solid contribution and a vital one to being able to sustain Ukraine's war effort. On the tanks front, this is, I think, maybe more interesting, is that, so for context here, previously Rheinmetall had said they were offering Ukrainian government, they're offering that they would build a Panther factory in Ukraine, the KF-51 Panther being their quote-unquote next generation main battle tank they're currently trying to offer to the market. It's not really fully developed yet. It's very low technological readiness level. In its current form, it's basically just a turret technology demonstrator on a modified Leopard 2A4 hull. But despite the fact that it's an extremely immature product, they were offering to build a factory to produce them in Ukraine with a timeline of 12 to 18 months. It was supposed to be co-located with a Fuchs armored personnel carrier plant that has already begun construction in Western Ukraine. That plant will initially provide repair and refurb capacity for Fuchs APCs that I believe will be coming from German industrial stocks, as well as potentially Bundeswehr stocks. So those will be repaired and refurbed at that plant and then enter Ukrainian service. Phase two of that plant will add production capacity for 400 Fuchs annually at that plant. So they will be assembled from scratch in Ukraine. And then there was more or less a proposed phase three to add a Panther main battle tank production line at that same plant. What Rheinmetall's CEO said in this interview seems to be separate from that effort or that proposal, and he's now said that they are more or less asking to lease two old, quote, well-equipped Soviet armored fighting vehicle plants in Ukraine, and that they will more or less use those plants to set up either one or two production lines for main battle tanks. Which is a really interesting comment because, again, that there's a discrepancy there with the prior Panther proposal. What the specific wording of this suggests to me is that he specifically referenced well-equipped plants. If they wanted to produce Panther at any of these older plants they'd be taking over operation of, they'd need to re-equip and retool the whole thing for Panther. So my read of it is that I think Rheinmetall might be offering to produce T-64s and T-84s for the Ukrainian government at these plants. I suspect that's probably what this is about. I know Reznikov announced that several months ago that the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense was placing an order for new build T-84s. As far as I'm aware, based upon some reporting from Ukrainska Pravda regarding Voronezhprom, they don't really currently have the capacity to produce T-84s. This is a point of consternation between UOP and the MOD. Did the MOD place this order without asking without actually seeing if UOP had the capacity to produce main battle tanks at all. So that really makes me think that Rheinmetall will probably spin up production of either the T-64 or the T-84, because I can't imagine that they would want to lease an old Soviet AFV plant that is explicitly well-equipped just to spend all the time and money to re-equip and retool the whole thing for Panther. So, again, that's my read of it. I could be incorrect on that, but that's what seemed to be indicated by his specific word choice.
That would indeed be interesting if Rheinmetall were to produce those legacy equipment in Ukraine. Colby, please go ahead.
John, is there any indication whether Rheinmetall's production increases can be attributable to their own facilities that they already had, or is this because they just purchased Expal, which is a very large manufacturer of artillery ammunition in Spain?
I'm not 100% sure. I think there were some delays to the Spanish venture in terms of ramping up their capacity, but I'm not fully read up on the details of that. I know that they were offering to one of the key components that Rheinmetall previously referenced in terms of hitting the 600K target. I believe the CEO made reference to this early beginning of this year, late last year, was that they had planned to build a new plant somewhere in Germany that would be very important to them hitting that target to expanding their capacity. So the Spanish plant is probably part of it, but at least at the time, 8 months ago or so, there was a proposed new German plant that would play a very important role in helping them meet that capacity target.
Yeah, maybe just one thing to add, Colby. So, I mean, I was actually kind of thinking the same thing because of that acquisition last year. As far as I remember, and just checking through some of the Expal press releases, but they were primarily focused on smaller caliber munitions. Of course, that wouldn't necessarily prevent them from scaling up production for larger caliber ones, but that was what I remember their key competency to be, but maybe I'm wrong. Go ahead, Colby, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, they do produce 155, and in fact, I seem to recall them producing a fairly significant quantity of 155, but I'd have to go back and double check, but you know, Cameron did a thread about this, and I recall him having some information about Expal having fairly robust capacity to turn out 155 ammunition. So I'll go take a look at that and see what numbers he had.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. So I just want to round up. Thank you very much, John, for all the information today. Is there anything to add before I move on?
I don't believe so. There was some potential, there was some other Gripen optimizations compared to the F-16 stuff, but if we need to move on to other segments, that's totally fine. It's not really a pressing issue.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, I just want to give just a really short update on the current situation in the front lines before handing it back to Jonathan for our next segment. Essentially, the front lines remain unchanged in any significant way. However, there is some good news, especially in the Robotny Axis, as the Ukrainian armed forces continue to push into that town. They now control somewhere between a third to a half of it, but it appears that the Russians have abandoned positions on the south side of that town and have then withdrawn to fortifications. What's also interesting in that area is that from this small salient that has been created through their attacks on Robotny, the Ukrainians have started to attack from west to east, essentially getting behind or looking to get behind some of the front lines further to the east. These are the kinds of things we might expect. Clearly, there are fortifications that are designed to stop these kinds of things, but moving laterally to the line of contact is often better than approaching it frontally. Also, then, the only other major news is around Eurozhiny, so on the Velika Novosilka axis as the Ukrainians continue to push south. So the entire town of Eurozhiny has been taken, and Ukrainians are now pushing south from that town up the river valley towards the next village and villages. The biggest one that we're looking at here is Staromelnivka. That is a really hard one to say, but we shall see. There again, step by step, moving methodically through all of the mine obstacles, fortifications that they encounter. They have not reached what we would consider the largest line of fortifications that doesn't necessarily mean that it is the most difficult to crack. It's just the ones that we can all see via satellite imagery. We will see what happens when the Ukrainian armed forces are able to push another few kilometers to the south and hit that. But otherwise, no major news to report from the ground lines. Contact, airstrikes, artillery strikes, counter-artillery, this all continues on both sides. But I just wanted to give that short update, and then maybe I can hand it over to Jonathan for the next segment. Not sure. Are we all set up?
All set up. Thank you, Charles. And thank you, Colby. Thank you, John. We are delighted to be joined by Daniela, who has unique insight into manufacture of ammunition through open source material. So he is going to give us, a walkthrough of how certain ammunition, which is currently given to Ukraine by the UK, is produced, and how we can potentially increase that. So welcome up to the panel, Daniela.
Hi, good evening to everyone. And this work that has been done in the last few weeks essentially has been based on trying to gather any type of information about artillery shell production. And I focus essentially in UK because there is a quite substantial amount of information available, and also a good history to tell to the audience, which in some aspect reflects the same history of the management of the storage of any type of ammunition in general, but artillery in particular, after the end of the Cold War. Now, essentially, what we can say is that if we want to walk through the history, the past history and the recent history of UK, prior this war and prior to 2005, the manufacturing of all the type of ammunition from small, medium, and large caliber was essentially state-owned and state-led. And the office that was entitled to work on this aspect was the Royal Ordnance Factory, which was, if you wish, like a very big consortium of medium, large, and small factories spread across the UK. And they worked for the MOD, and essentially they were not working for a profit, but they were working for producing a service, if you wish. But this service started around 1930. And ended its life. Last factory closed around 1987, and just barely before the end of the Cold War. And after this, the sector was slowly given to the private companies through public appointment. And in this case, in particular, for small, medium, and large caliber, VA system from 2005. Around 2005 up to today, has been committed in the production of this type of ammunition. This type of approach has been widespread all over Europe, because as you can imagine, after the end of the great threat of the Soviet Union, many governments decided that there was no need of having such large production capabilities, and in some cases, not even a very large storage. Most of the nation in Europe moved on a production on demand and on requirement rather than stockpiling, essentially. And in terms of UK, I think the UK model can be seen as one of the most successful on some aspect, because it has been working and improving across the years, but also one of the most common across the EU. Just to mention a few numbers, the last package of funding to BAE, to the production of ammunition, was about £2.4 billion, and should span from 2020 to 2035-ish, for so 15 years of the contract. But due to the recent events of the 24th of September, it was essentially obsolete at that point. In fact, as you may know, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak asked to BAE to improve the production, and there is a general commitment across the ally, but in this case specifically for UK, to improve by 8 times the current production capabilities of any type of artillery shell. And so far the advancement has been significant, but as we will see, is not exactly matching the requirement for a high intensity conflict as the one that is currently occurring in Ukraine. Now, in UK, we have generally speaking, three main factories, one based in Washington, which essentially works on large and medium ammunition, and so 155, 105 artillery shell, 81 millimeter mortar bomb, and around all the caliber from 20, but especially 30 millimeter. The other very big plant that works on the filling instead is based in Glasgow. Now, I'm a bit jumping from a concept to the other, so because you have to understand, but probably many of you knows that making the shell is not everything, because making the shell is a manufacturing process, but not the entire process. So the other side of the medal is try to fill the shell with explosive, and this is done in only one factory, which is in Glasgow plant in the south of England. And there is also another factory that works only on small arms, which I didn't report it in the slide because it's a bit out of the context, but you can find in the nice map, which is Radaway Green. And this produces roughly a million round small caliber per day. So it's the biggest manufacturer for UK for small caliber ammunition. Now, the war, of course, in some aspect shown the difficulties of scaling up, because the factory that currently is working in Washington is very advanced, has a nearly complete autonomous line, so it's capable of working nearly H24/7/07, but of course need some human presence on the factory floor. The plant is barely new because it was finished and commissioned in around 2012, and was a part of a £206 million investment, especially for making the process completely autonomous, but also to buy the presses, which are the core of the Washington plan in particular, and is the core manufacturing tool that is required to transform a square billet in rough artillery shell that after this needs to be machined, cleaned, inspection, and then sent to the filling station. So I'm oversimplifying just to give you an overview. At the moment, the numbers, of course, is very difficult to obtain the real numbers, but there are different sources where you can look for example, there are several publications from BAE itself, like Airbus, which stopped to do publication strangely after 2014. And by looking at these, by cross-looking at the data that we have from the MOD, which normally publish in the requirement when companies apply for this type of project, we can say that the prior war, the current production of mortar bomb, for example, was around 75,000 mortar bomb per year, which is not a lot, especially if you think mortar are a relatively simple weapon, but also a relatively simple object to manufacture. Doesn't have the same level of complexity of many other ammunition. In terms of large caliber, this is a bit conflictual, and I was speaking with John some days ago, because I found essentially that roughly 16,000 rounds are produced per month prior to the invasion. But the problem is that when you read the large caliber, this also doesn't mean exactly 155. And the UK has a lot of howitzer that works with the 105. So this number hide a bit of also the truth of what is in reality the production of 155, which now looks like the more compelling requirement for Ukraine. On this particular aspect, it's also important to underline that the government pushed a lot in the production on 155 millimeter, and I think this was especially in looking forward, not only to help Ukraine, but also looking forward to a standardization of artillery through ally. And so if we have to think about all these situation at the moment, so the current situation in all the countries in Europe is more or less the same. Essentially, we have a series of defense industries that are trying to, prior to the war, they were trying to meet requirements of peacetime, and now they have very large demands. but we don't know exactly how much commitment there is from the government, which have to take political but also economical decision. And to give you a very important example, many people think that, okay, so if we want to produce more ammunition, we just need to build like a clone factory of, for example, the one in Washington at the time. Well, this is true. It's feasible, it's possible, but takes time. And by speaking with different experts in the field, in order to build and make operative without any problem with all the money that you need, so in the best condition, even having a very well-motivated and good workforce that build the plant, you need at least 10 months. Because this is not happened at the moment, it's probably not going to happen anytime soon. And there are different possibilities for this. The first is that committing to a new plant means investing for sure a large amount of money, and government always are reluctant on how to justify such big investment. And on some side is also understandable, because coming from a peace period, there is not the understanding of the importance of having such capability when you really need to scale up. In fact, I would say that having more factories, even in idle condition or dormant condition, is like an insurance policy. It's true, you pay a little bit to keep these in decent condition in case you need them, but when you need, is your insurance policy. And now we're essentially without insurance. So for this reason, now we are seeing UK doing fairly well from what are the news, not because I'm from that. Norwegian Nammo is doing very well, but the rest of Europe is struggling. And there are many reasons why they are struggling. It's not only a problem of committing resources, also a problem of logistics. You have to imagine that producing at the same time across Europe the same object, and maybe many of you remember COVID, when everyone needed a certain tube for a respirator, a certain type of mask, when collectively all we need the same type of resource, this resource immediately finished and it's very difficult to gather. So there are probably problems in this area, not for the metal at the moment, to my knowledge, but probably for the chemical aspect, for the explosive, for the manufacturing of the fill, the actual filling of the bomb. So all this brings to the conclusion that, of course, there is a need of increasing the commitment and try to push policies that will enable a more aggressive production and aggressive investment in order to sustain the production. Because it's not enough building more factories. You need to build all the environment that allows this factory to operate and to being efficient. And my personal view on this aspect, but this is just my own view, is that an example, a very good example, come from history. And during the Second World War, UK has to convert part of its civilian industry into military production. And this because building new factories at the time was not even the problem. The problem was training the people. Having people that were able to immediately go and produce stuff. So the same problem may be a bit relaxed, but or extended to other higher level of understanding of the subject is occurring today in terms of engineer, highly specialized technician. So probably a good solution or tampon solution at the moment would be try to see across Europe which factories, which companies working in steel manufacturing, in high precision manufacturing, could divert their civil production into the war effort. And this way, of course, this has pros and cons. It's not like special and unique solution to a problem that has no cons. The cons will be a problem in, of course, controlling the quality across different factories, controlling the possibility of delivering and having always the factory with what they need, so essentially logistic. But these are problems that can be fixed, can be overcome. And the potential benefit is that you have a very complex or very long process divided in different tasks and parallelized, in order to try to improve the output. without committing to new factories, or meanwhile you wait for new factories. Because as I said at the beginning, if we decide today to go ahead and build a factory, it will take at least 10 months, a year. And we are not even in time for the, probably for the second offensive. So this is my point. And as last, as a cherry on the cake, if you wish, we can see that there is also benefit in investing in this, because of course the need of increasing production, at least in UK, but this is probably occurring everywhere in Europe, is bringing work. So a lot of there are at least 400 new employee high paid jobs in these industries. So on some extent, is also this a good selling point for the public to explain we are investing in our defense, we are investing in defending and helping an allied country which is facing an aggressor, but also we are trying to invest on the local economy, and trying to do these things in-house. So this is just an overview, very gentle touch on this very significant problem that is affecting the war effort, because as we know, the several reports tell us that the Ukrainian artillery is not able, especially mortars, is not able to cover with the current supply the level, the rate of fire that they really need to become very effective and try to sacrifice, do not sacrifice so many lives when they are attacked the defensive Russian lines. So if you have any question, I'm very happy to ask. I want to keep this light. So if you have any, thank you.
Thank you, Daniela. Thank you, Daniela. First of all, thank you for the slides, the nested slides you've put up there for our live listeners. Our listeners on Spotify or Apple, of course, can find those on the timeline of the Totally Twitter account. They really lay out what the UK's capacity is at the moment according to open source material. So that first slide on the far right, for example, you've detailed the current known manufacturing places and the number of jobs which the people in that area, which give employment to the people within that area. I guess I've got two questions. So it's not news, of course, that Ukraine's liberators are in need of mortar ammunition and 155 ammunition. Is the UK's artillery and mortar manufacturing currently capable of meeting the UK's commitments to the ZSU? And is there any way, is there any way that's the way that we produce mortar and 155 ammo can be changed to, you know, to maybe reduce the standards slightly, but to maintain, you know, to maintain health and safety practice within the manufacturing process? I'm just kind of thinking of how Russia produces these things, and the far higher quality that is employed within Western ammunition manufacturing. So those are my two questions. Are we currently meeting our commitments to the ZSU? And if not, is there anything we can do to change the way that we manufacture this ammunition? Thanks.
Oh, thank you for the question. So regarding the commitment, now I don't know exactly how much has been committed. So I don't know exactly each MOD how many resources has promised and has delivered. But from what we can see, Kiev Independent made a very harsh, honestly, article, and they were pointing their finger especially to Germany, Italy, continental Europe, excluding Norway and essentially the northern part of Europe and UK, because these last countries, in terms of artillery, they outperformed. I mean, their small capacities at the starting of the war, but there was a promise of 1 million round, and I think the EU attempt to meet this 1 million round went in failure, because I think they still have time because there was a deadline. I don't remember when the deadline is, but on this article that I will later on post on the Nest, they just produced like 200,000 collectively, all the nations. So this is really sad, because I mean, Nammo was able to produce 19,000. So how is possible this? I mean, it's not possible that France, Germany, Italy, Greece, whatever, they don't have the capabilities collectively to do more than better than what they did. So yes, there is a lack. We are failing in doing this, and probably probably related to the fact that we always relied on the fact, well, at some point our American friends will help us. But by big surprise, we saw that at the very beginning, US was in difficulty as well. So, and have to rely on its own stocks of material. And when they saw they were essentially going down very quickly, there is a problem, we have to act. And they act very fast. So now they are catching up. So I don't think we are meeting the good requirement. We are barely scratching the minimum, probably. On some opinion of many others, we are not even going for the minimum. We are going very, very below the minimum. And of course, there is also, you know, there is a good point and a bad point. This is the bad point. The good point is that the system that we provide, that fire, the 155 and the others, are very accurate. So Ukrainian can shot less and shot in a more effective way. That's true. But when you need to do many, many fire mission in a day, doesn't matter how precise you are, you need more. So that's a very big problem. So your second question was about changing or trying to speed up by changing some kind of tolerances or some kind of work practice. Now, I've been thinking on this a lot, and I came to the conclusion that by experience, that this is probably not going to change much. And I explain you very, very simply why. So that how a factory works, especially if it's managed by private companies, that as much material I gather, raw material, and I put inside my black box, which is my factory, I want that the most of the material that go in came out as a final product that I can sell. I mean, that's very simple to understand. So if this have to happen, I need to be able to do not reject shells. So you can imagine that at the level of production that we have, it's very unlikely that there will be so many shells that end up being sent back rather than sent to Ukraine, because then is a cost. Any shell that doesn't come properly out is a cost for the company. The company doesn't want to waste money. So in this aspect, the capitalistic approach works, because you want to be efficient and you don't want to waste time, because also the more you produce, the more you gain. But at the same time, there are some areas where we can maybe try to shrink a bit. For example, tolerances during some particular checks, optical checks, can be done in some factory are still done by an operator that has to use a particular probe. In other factory are done by a robot, which can work in a much higher pace. So these are things that can be improved, and there are works in this direction. But the main problem is that when you produce an artillery shell, after it comes out from the, for example, from the press, may have to wait 10 hours cooling down. So there are a lot of dead times that you can't really avoid unless you change dramatically the process. But this is not something that you are going to do in a period like this. So on this aspect, I think that we can improve. We can, you know, remove some minutes, we can increase for sure. But I think at this point, the level of knowledge on the topic is at that point that you just need more tools to produce more rather than trying to make cut on quality. Also because cut on quality, in the best case scenario, cut on accuracy. Because you don't want to cut at the point that you can damage the barrel or kill someone.
Yeah, that makes sense, Daniela. I'm a layman to this. So, like, you know, imagine... Like I'm trying to picture this process, and you've detailed this in a couple of your slides. So I'm a shell. How does my life begin? How do I end up palletized outside the factory and ready to be shipped on a C-17? How could you kind of explain to me, like, like the length of time here involved in that process?
Well, your life most of the time start as a very long bar of HF1, which is a high fragmentation steel, which is a particular steel which is able to do what you don't want from a steel, so to shatter when it's subjected to high speed deformation, like an explosion. So it's done in this way because you want the steel to be kind of weak, but in the point that it is shattered and create debris, because you want to kill people essentially. Now you start your life as a very long bar. You end up in a cold workshop where you are cut in small billets, which are essentially chunks of steel, and essentially a conveyor slowly bring you in a furnace, which can be of different type: gas fired, induction. Induction are those operated in Washington, for example, because they are more modern, they smaller, they have a lot of pros and some cons. But essentially you are heat treated, your temperature is increased for a series of reasons from material point of view, but mainly because you need the material to become very, very hot, because at that temperature your resistance to deformation is very low. So I can essentially apply on you pressure with a press and give you the shape that I want. So as a billet, you exit from the furnace, you end up by different means, conveyor, human taking you with some kind of manipulator or just a robot, and the robot plays you in a die in a forge, which the type of forge can be different, but the end result is that you are essentially squashed by inside a closed die. And normally what happens, the very first shape is like a cylinder. And normally this cylinder has like the back of the cylinder has kind of small feature that normally is used later on to grab the shell and hold in a CNC machine. So you are very hot at this point. There is nothing that can be done. So you are left cooling down in an area. Normally you arrive in this area with another conveyor. And once you are cooled, normally are done some eccentricity, some check. So you are checked by the doctors in order to see if all the dimensions are up to spec. Normally this is done prior cooling and after cooling. And after this, you get again in the same or another press, where your hand shape is given by a different type of die. So essentially from a cylinder, you become a shell. At this point, you are moved inside your brother and sister inside a furnace. Normally you are there for a certain amount of time, few hours, and once the temperature is arrived to the one that is needed, you are dropped slowly in a hot not hot sorry in an oil bath, which allows your material to become a little bit more brittle, and this will increase the creation of shrapnel when the shell explode. So this is a quenching process. After that, most of the time what happens is that you are get washed, in some cases sunblasted, CNC machined, the different fillets are applied for inserting the fuse, and painted. Once you are painted, in some cases numbers are also applied, and then you are shipped to the filling station. In the middle of this process, there are some checks, of course. Most of the time are visual, but sometimes are also done with particular sensor that can measure with a tactile probe your dimension and check that your dimension are exactly the same of what should be done in the specs. And then you are shipped to the filling station. The filling station is where the final process really occur. So you are filled with explosive. Normally, different shells are lying all together, and you enter in a machine, and you have a metal funnel on the top. This machine inject the explosive that then have to cure in special oven. And once this process is finished, you have essentially the shell. Oh, I forgot that during the CNC machining, normally they apply the copper band, which are the seal that normally are on the back of the shell. So the process is quite long. A shell can take even a day alone in terms of hours, 24 hours, to be produced. But the fact that the factory works continuously doesn't show you the intensity of the work behind, because it's a continuous process. There is always stuff occurring on the shop floor.
Thank you, Daniela. I can tell the standards of quality control are very high. Could you tell us about the site? I'm looking at the slide on the presses that you've done here, on like the third one in from the right. Would you say the size of the presses within this manufacturing process, what kind of scalability would you say is a realistic time frame here for the UK to adequately meet its commitments to the ZSU?
So what do you mean for building a new one and like a twin factory like the one that they have in Washington?
Yes.
Well, as I said to you priorly, is no less than 10 months, because in all this you need the press manufacturer need the time to build and install the press. Now, if everything is done properly, these 10 months are feasible, because now you order the press, so the manufacturer Schroeder start to produce in Germany the press, and then in the meantime you take a good workforce of people and you start to build the building, but also the foundation where the press has to be. And probably this is the most important things, because you want this part to be ready as soon as possible, because as soon as you have the foundation for the press ready, you can then concentrate on all the rest. And when the press arrives from Germany, you can install it. Because if you don't start immediately to build, then you may have, and this is not uncommon, happen that the press arrives and then you don't have where to place it. So you need to wait. So 10 months, a year, if everything goes smooth, you have experienced people and also no problem in terms of money and any other type of authorization. So everything goes well.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Daniela. So we've been, we're lucky to say that we've re-established connection with our friend in the Dnipro, Vasil. So if it's okay, Daniela, could I ask you for any concluding thoughts about your segment?
Oh, yeah. I think that the most important things at this point is each of us has the possibility to write to MPs, to try to sensibilize other people. I think that if we want really to help Ukraine, we need to scale up artillery, shell and mortar bomb at the very least, because it's the cheapest and the easiest way to produce as much as possible. And this will require for sure the policy maker doing their work. So try to put money, but also policies that will enable solution, because any type of engineer that works in this field knows that these challenges can be solved, but they can do their work only if they have a plan, which they cannot do. If defense industries, especially private one as we have now, cannot say, oh, okay, I will build another factory because I think really that democracy is important. I mean, even if they believe in that, they are not going to do this because they are private companies. So they need the commitment of the government that say, that's the direction, we do that. So this would be very important, because it would allow defense industry to scale up by building new infrastructure. But at the same time, as I told you, this requires time. And because we wasted a lot of time, then we need to try to do what we have done in the past where we were in difficulties. So try to appeal to very good industrial background, which we have across Europe, Germany, Spain, Italy, UK, and try to find a set of industries that can cope, not all the process, but different part of the process. So the entire history that I very in a very simplified way I say to you can be distributed across the country, and this can work because all this process takes days. So if we can do this in parallel, the logistic problem that there are between moving things from place to the other will be nearly invisible, especially if we work very well. So I think there is a need of help from the policymaker, from the government that have to commit resources, but also give a precise vision, which cannot be, oh, in 2028, we will produce 8 times what we produce today. No, because at that day, hopefully the war will be over. Okay, you may prepare for China, that's fine. But this is not this war. We need the solution for this one, not for the next, at least not now.
Thank you, Daniela. We appreciate you bringing your unique insight to this and using the open source information that you have in your slides to elucidate on this topic. Thank you. Faisal, it's a pleasure to see you here. Can you give us a quick mic check?
Hello. Sorry for my bad connection again.
We can hear you loud and clear, Faisal. It's a pleasure to have you back. Welcome. Faisal, I've got a couple of questions for you. Westerners in my part of the world and those of Ukraine's allies that are listening in right now, we've seen Ukrainians courageously continuing many parts of their lives during this war. Can you give us an example of one of the traditions which Ukrainians either generally or in Dnipro practiced on Ukrainian Independence Day?
Thanks, Jonathan. First of all, hello to everyone. And I want to say thanks to Daniela. It's very interesting and it's significant to Ukraine to receive enough shells because artillery is very important in this war. And Jonathan, about your question, we have a lot of different traditions. We have different things that I can tell. Some traditions going from time of Cossacks. Dnipro is situated near the Zaporizhia region. It's, I think, maybe 60 or maybe 70 kilometers. It's really near. And in Zaporizhia city, there is Zaporizhka Sich. It's historical. Also, it is now a museum. Also, it is now territory which are secured by war. And also, even not now, I say before 2022, on Independence Day, many Ukrainians go to Zaporizhka Sich because there were very big celebrations. Also, there were some people who live even now in Zaporizhka Sich and have a life like Cossacks life. And also they make some historical, I can't say this word, but some historical training, some historical exercises, some historical reproduction, maybe something like that. And it's very cool to be there. You feel history of our people, of our nation. It's one of tradition on Independence Day. Also, many Ukrainians and I am also go to Kyiv on Independence Day because very often there were a concert of Okeanelze. It's Ukrainian rock group. It's very famous for Ukrainian. This rock group, I think last times before 2022, their concerts maybe 20,000 people, 30,000, even more. It's stadiums they had.
It sounds like a wonderful community. I love rock concerts. And would you say that this aspect has been impacted by the full-scale invasion of your country, or would you say that it's adapted?
I say that now we don't have such concerts. It's already, I think, understandable. We saw what was yesterday in Chernihiv. We understand that something like that can be in most part of our country. That is why such concerts we don't have now. And I agree with this, absolutely. About tradition with the Zaporizhia region, Cossacks, and also, I can't say 100% that there is no such shares production, but I think it isn't work like it worked before full invasion.
Yeah,
because there is a museum there, there's reconstruction of buildings. It's very nice place, and I think if you're interested in Ukrainian tradition and Ukrainian history, you should go there. But I propose it to do after our win, not now.
Thanks, Vasil. Vasil, if you had to teach one Ukrainian tradition to a British person like myself, I'm not going to attach these attributes to myself, but a British person who couldn't cook and couldn't dance, what tradition would you teach? And there is one rule, my friend. You can't teach being a snob, because the British are apparently best at that.
Jonathan, it is so many rules that I am not sure that I can say in some tradition which can be under so many rules. I need to think. Maybe it is very simple. You can have a tradition in this month. We have a tradition to go to the church, which some products like as honey, apple, and something like that, because we have now, I think, how to say, it is Annie's Pass. It's Ukrainian traditional celebration in this month when you... Oh, it's complicated to explain why, but we have such tradition. It's simple.
That sounds good enough for me.
Yeah.
Thank you, Rasmus.
But if you want to cook something interesting, I can propose draniki. It's something like potato pancakes. It's really tasty and crispy.
That sounds absolutely delicious. Vasil, just before we close, is there anything you'd like to say to our audience? Any thoughts for the week? The floor is yours, my friend.
Yesterday, first of all, I want to say that we understand and we understand that it's not obligation, it's our will to say thank you to about contribution of all free world, because it's, I think, significant help. Without what, I think it will be very, very complicated, or I think we have maybe lost more many territories, many peoples, more many childs. I don't even imagine what it can be if free world don't support Ukraine. That is why I want to say thank you to everyone that you still support, that you still contribute, that you still are here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Vasil. Over to you, Jose.
Thank you, Gotham and Vasil. So, to our live listeners, if you're interested in more open source information about the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine, Toshny recommends Michael Bond Space, which goes live right after ours, should be live just about now. Thank you for listening to Toshny Weekly. We broadcast live at 1800 UTC every Sunday. A recording of this episode and all our content is made available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Thank you for our excellent panel this week for all their contributions. And thank you to our listeners. We hope you guys enjoyed the broadcast. And please tune in next week. Slava Ukraini.
Hello, I'm Slava.
On behalf of the brave.